Hi, friends. How are we doing today? Thank you for being here, whether you're here in person or joining us online. We're thrilled you're a part of what God's doing at Capital Church this weekend. Today we continue a series we've called The Life and Lyrics of David. We're looking at David's life as God prepares him to be the leader of God's people. And as we're reading David's story, we're reflecting on David's soul. We're studying some of the songs that he wrote during this time period. Last week we watched as David's seemingly charmed life came apart at the seams. Well, this week, David's circumstances move from bad to worse. In fact, we'll begin today's story of David with his song. Throughout this song, and throughout this series, I mean, we're hoping to give you a glimpse of the different genres of psalms that David wrote so that you'll grasp what's going on when you read them on your own. But see, today's psalm is a little different. It catches most people off guard when they read it. It sounds less like a hymn you'd sing in church and more like a rant you'd hear on the radio. But the song is something significant to teach us nonetheless. So before I introduce it to you, let's ask God to help us learn. Will you pray with me? Lord, as we read the lyrics to an angry song of hurt and betrayal, may you heal our hurts and the wounds we've received from others. Lord, I pray you open our eyes to see how mysteriously and magnificently you worked in David's story. And may you help us to trust you to work in our story too. We pray this in the name of King Jesus. Amen. Recently, our world experienced a day when everybody fixed their eyes in a single direction together for a single moment. And no, I am not talking about the solar eclipse. I'm talking about the fateful moment on Thursday evening at 10 p.m. Mountain Time when I'm certain you were all shook by the release of Taylor Swift's new album. It's called The Tortured Poets Department. And only 2 full days after its release, the project is breaking records left and right. On Friday, Spotify revealed that Swift's new work is the first to accrue 200 million streams in a single day. That is until they announced on Saturday that it had actually surpassed 300 million streams on day one. My daughter, who is widely regarded as a Taylor Swift aficionado, warned me in advance, "Dad, this is going to be another breakup album." Sure enough, out of the 17 songs on the record, only one tune would I label a true love song. The other 16 were laments. In So Long London, she indicts a former lover. "You swore that you loved me, but where were the clues? I died on the altar waiting for the proof." Describing what must have been a relationship with a controlling person, Taylor pens the lyrics of her song fresh out of the slammer. "Handcuffed to the spell I was under for just 1 hour of sunshine, years of labor, locks and ceilings, and the shade of how he was feeling. But it's going to be all right. I did my time." Referring to the short-lived relationship with a bad boy, Taylor pleads, "They shook their heads, saying, 'God help her,' when I told him he's my man. But your good Lord didn't need to lift a finger. I can fix him. No, I really can." I laughed out loud when I read the song's final lyric. "Whoa, maybe I can't." In her song LOML, which by the way stands for Love of My Life, Taylor offers this spot of happiness. "Oh, what a valiant roar. What a bland goodbye. The coward claimed he was a lion. I'm combing through the braids of lies. I'll never leave. Never mind. You're the loss of my life. Switch is currently on the international leg of her Eras tour. It's already the highest grossing concert tour of all time. It's the first tour to surpass $1 billion in revenue. But apparently in the early months of the tour, Taylor powered through every performance with a broken heart. And she wrote about it. I cry a lot, but I'm so productive, it's an art. You know you're good when you can even do it with a broken heart. And I'm good because I'm miserable and nobody even knows. Try and come for my job. Often her songs feel like texts she wrote but meant to delete that got sent by accident. And in plain sight you hid, but you are what you did. And I'll forget you, but I'll never forgive the smallest man who ever lived. I kind of get the feeling she's upset. Now, I think one reason her music's so successful is the fans feel the songwriter's drama viscerally. They've grown to care about Taylor's story personally. And when they hear her story and sing her songs, they consider their own stories of betrayal and their own melancholy songs of heartache. Taylor knows this about her fans, so 2 hours after the release of the album, she tweets this. It's a 2 a.m. surprise. The Tortured Poets Department is a secret double album. I've written so much tortured poetry in the past 2 years and wanted to share it all with you. So here's the second installment of TTPD, the anthology. 15 extra songs. And now the story isn't mine anymore. It's all yours. One of those extra songs is a song with a single word title, I'm Gonna Get You Back. Now, if you think about it, the title may refer to revenge or reconciliation. And I'm honestly not sure which. Taylor doesn't seem to be sure either as she writes, whether I'm gonna be your wife or gonna smash up your bike, I haven't decided yet, but I'm gonna get you back. Whether I'm gonna curse you out or take you back to my house, I haven't decided yet, but I'm gonna get you back. Though she may be the best, Taylor Swift is not the first artist to sing about heartache and heartbreak. Consider a generation before her, Alanis Morissette. Or a generation before that, Carly Simon. You may know her ironic lyric, "You're so vain, you probably think this song is about you." Well, with all these artists, what they hold in common is the recognition that music can capture the essence of our disappointment and devastation in a way mere words never could. Now, if you're wondering why I'm talking about the catharsis of sad and sour songs, it's because today's psalm does something similar. Psalm 52, however, is not a song about a broken heart. It's a song about a bitter betrayal. See, not all songs in the Psalter are written to God. Psalm 52 is mostly written to an enemy. Let me read a few verses. Why do you boast of evil, you mighty hero? Why do you boast all day long, you who are a disgrace in the eyes of God? You who practice deceit, your tongue plots destruction. It's like a sharpened razor. You love evil rather than good, falsehood rather than speaking the truth. You love every harmful word, you deceitful tongue. Surely God will bring you down to everlasting ruin. He will snatch you up and pluck you from your tent. He will uproot you from the land of the living. Now, what in the world are we supposed to learn from a song like that? Well, we know we're supposed to learn something because of a word that shows up in the psalm's superscription. Many of the psalms come affixed with a heading. Psalm 52 tells us that this song is for the director of music, a maskil of David. We saw that word maskil last week. In Hebrew, maskil is probably derived from the verb sachal, which means to teach or instruct. Now that would make this a psalm of instruction. Apparently, it tells us how to do something. And the superscription or heading of Psalm 52 also tells us more about the psalm's backstory. It says it was written when Doeg the Edomite had gone to Saul and told him, David has gone to the house of Ahimelech. Now, you may not know the story of David and Doeg. I'll tell it to you in a moment. But I think it's obvious. Psalm 52 is written by David after he's been wounded. But if you'll pardon my modernization of the text, these wounds don't come from just anyone. They don't come from someone at work. They don't come from someone at school. They come from someone at church, among God's people. Look, people fail all the time. Politicians, public figures, people fail all the time. But it's especially disappointing when God's people fail. It's especially discouraging when people appointed by God, people identified with God, fail to live a life worthy of their calling. It's disillusioning when we find sin in the sanctuary, as Eugene Peterson puts it. But that's often what happens. Some of us, at some point, have entered the life of a church community, expecting to find safety and security, only to find church people can be dangerous. Maybe you've been burned by God's people. You might be new to our community, not sure if you want to commit to our community because you've been burned by another community. Or maybe this is the first time you entered a church in years. In fact, you've made it a habit of avoiding church because the last time you went to church, your soul got seared. Well, this message today probably won't answer all your questions or heal all your wounds. But maybe it'll help you restart the conversation with God and give you a new perspective on where you should put your hope. Today, I hope you'll learn alongside David that though God's people fail, God's love will never fail. Before we unpack Psalm 52, I'd like to read the liner notes by telling you the backstory of David and Doeg. Remember, David was the anointed king of Israel. However, when David was anointed as king, he didn't automatically become king because there already was a king, and his name was Saul. But God got David where David needed to go by bringing him into the court of the king. God gave David favor with everyone in the kingdom, even the king, until the king got jealous. When the king got jealous, his affection soured, becoming irrational anger. And he turned all the resources of Israel against young David. In the Old Testament book of 1 Samuel, we see David escaping with only the shirt on his back. And we catch up with him in a desperate moment, 1 Samuel 21, beginning in verse 1. David went to Nob to Ahimelech, the priest. One of the first places David runs is to the sanctuary, the house of God. Church is often the first place people go in desperate moments. I remember that literally being true in childhood. One May evening in 1986, my family was watching a softball game when a severe thunderstorm blew in out of nowhere. It brought with it a tornado that leveled 39 homes in my suburban city. I distinctly recall the concrete slabs left after that tornado tore through my neighborhood. The storm blew through so fast, we couldn't get home in time to take cover. But our little church was right around the corner, and our church had a basement. So that night, we raced to that sanctuary to find a couple dozen people from our community who had the same idea. The storm took away our electricity, but we sat together by candlelight in that dark church basement praying for our city. Church is often the first place people go in desperate moments. Many have found, as Dallas Willard put it, God's address is at the end of your rope. And the first place we look when we're at the end of our rope is God. And the first place we look for God is God's house. God's house is often where our eyes are open to see God's work around us. The sanctuary often helps us see God when we're having trouble seeing him. So David flees from Saul to find sanctuary in the house of God. However, verse 1 continues. Ahimelech trembled when he met him and asked, "Why are you alone? Why is no one with you?" The priest is panicked. Why is David breathless and by himself? VIPs like David don't go places without an entourage. David answered Ahimelech the priest, "The king sent me on a mission and said to me, 'No one is to know anything about the mission I'm sending you on. As for my men, I have told them to meet me at a certain place.'" Okay, friends, there's no getting around this. David lies. God's man deceives God's priest in God's house. And this is not a white lie without consequence, as you'll see soon enough. Just remember what we've discussed in the past when we've read stories from the Old Testament. Biblical narratives don't necessarily prescribe behavior. Sometimes they're just reporting what happened. As we read David's story in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, Eugene Peterson reminds us, in the process of attending to this story, we realize that good and bad are not as easily distinguishable as we wish they were. Saul the bad king is not all bad, and David the good king is not all good. There is tension and ambiguity, testing and temptation all through the narrative. The story of salvation is never a cut and dried black and white scheme. It takes place in the colorful mess and pageantry of history. He says black and white are not, after all, the only two colors in the world. The divine sovereignty of God is not arbitrarily imposed on the parallel sovereign Saul and David, but painstakingly worked out from within their very human lives. By claiming he's on the king's secret assignment, David puts an end to the questions and gets to the purpose of his visit. He asks, "Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever you can find." But the priest answered David, I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. However, there is some consecrated bread here, provided the men have kept themselves from women." Ahimelech speaks about the showbread, which is to be eaten only by the priests. However, Ahimelech seems to discern human need trumps ritual law. He's implicitly applauded by Jesus for doing so in Mark 2 and Matthew 12. David receives the holy bread from the priest. However, our narrator interrupts the narrative to inform us. "Now one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. He was Doeg the Edomite, Saul's chief shepherd." With ominous foreshadowing, our storyteller says David wasn't the only worshiper in the sanctuary that day. Doeg the Edomite was there, hearing everything, seeing everything. Doeg was detained before the Lord, probably fulfilling a religious obligation. And Doeg reminds me, there are people who come into the house of God who aren't really interested in God. I'm not talking about sincere seekers asking honest questions. I'm talking about religious people who leverage religion to gain favor or status or reputation or a feeling of superiority. You can't usually discern that about someone at first, but eventually what's in them comes out of them, and good people get hurt. After we read this story in its entirety, I think you'll find it hard to believe Doeg is sincerely thinking about God when he visits the sanctuary at Nob that day. But we've returned to David. Verse 8, David asked Ahimelech, "Don't you have a spear or a sword here? I haven't brought my sword or any other weapon because the king's mission was urgent." The priest replied, "The sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, is here. It is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you want it, take it. There is no sword here but that one." It was in David's possession, but it probably ended up here in the house of God as a shrine to the great battle of David. David said, "There is none like it. Give it to me." That day, David fled from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. Now, fast forward to the next chapter. David is still running for his life from King Saul. So it's bad news indeed when Saul hears about his flight. Chapter 22, verse 6. Now Saul heard that David and his men had been discovered, and Saul was seated, spear in hand, under the tamarisk tree on the hill of Gibeah, with all his officials standing at his side. He said to them, "Listen, men of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse," that's David, "give all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make all of you commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Is that why you have all conspired against me? No one tells me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is concerned about me or tells me that my son has incited my servant to lie in wait for me as he does today." Friends, these are the complaints of a paranoid leader. No one's conspiring against Saul. David isn't lying in wait. In fear, Saul misreads reality. As I read these verses, I'm reminded, beware of following an insecure leader. Insecurity leads to self-centeredness. And a leader who leads with selfish ambition and vain conceit is a dangerous leader. To all who follow them or otherwise find themselves in their wake, power combined with selfish ambition and vain conceit makes for a toxic concoction. Here, Saul's looking for information about David, and Saul has the power to award informants with command of hundreds and thousands. Verse 9, but Doeg the Edomite, who was standing with Saul's officials, said, "I saw the son of Jesse come to Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, at Nob. Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him. He also gave him provisions and the sword of Goliath the Philistine." Now, Doeg doesn't consider the consequences the priest may face from this enraged ruler. There's no mention of David's deception. There's no mention of the priest's innocence. No, Doeg sees an opportunity. Doeg seizes an opportunity. The king sent for the priest Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, and all the men of his family who are the priests of Nob. And they all came to the king. Saul said, "Listen now, son of Ahitub." Saul said to him, "Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, giving him bread and a sword and inquiring of God for him, so that he has rebelled against me and lies in wait for me as he does today?" The priest responds like a seasoned diplomat. Ahimelech answered the king, "Who of all your servants is as loyal as David, the king's son-in-law, captain of your bodyguard, and highly respected in your household? Was that day the first time I inquired of God for David? Of course not. Let not the king accuse your servant or any of his father's family, for your servant knows nothing at all about this whole affair." So using rhetorical questions, he pleads his innocence without confronting the king and falsely accusing him. Remember, the priest genuinely has no idea what Saul's talking about. And he sought God for David on many of his campaigns. What in the world could have been wrong with supporting the king's son-in-law? But the king said, "You will surely die, Ahimelech, you and your whole family." Then the king ordered the guards at his side, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because they too have sided with David. They knew he was fleeing, yet they did not tell me." Saul has abandoned all reason. He decrees the death penalty for the priest and his family. But the king's officials were unwilling to raise a hand to strike the priests of the Lord. They feared God more than they feared the king. Now, that required great faith. Can you imagine the reaction of this irrational ruler foaming at the mouth as his closest confidants refuse his order? The king then ordered Doeg, "You turn and strike down the priests." Now Saul changes his verb. Strike down is the Hebrew word pagah, which doesn't mean kill. It means execute. He argues his legal justification for the slain. And Doeg doesn't need his arm twisted. Verse 18. So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck them down. That day he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. He also put to the sword Nob, the town of the priests, with its men and women, its children and infants, and its cattle, donkeys, and sheep. Sometimes good things happen in the sanctuary. The hungry find provision. The hurting find healing. The hopeless find hope. But like it did for David, sometimes the sanctuary offers bread for the journey and a sword for the fight. But sometimes horrifying, despicable things happen in the sanctuary. Sometimes the people God picked, like David, tell lies in the sanctuary. Sometimes God's appointed leadership, like King Saul, make unfair judgments based on jealousy and insecurity. Sometimes religious people, like Doeg, use their religion for selfish gain, though it shatters the lives of the most innocent. Have you been hurt in the sanctuary? Maybe you've been lied to. Maybe you've been gossiped about. Maybe you've been scarred by the critical and catty comments of God's people. Maybe you thought you were safe with someone, but that someone pressured you into doing something you never imagined doing. Maybe you've been worn down by shame and guilt from self-righteous people who wanted you to march to their beat. Friends, some of you have been wounded so seriously in the sanctuary, you're shocked you ever decided to darken the door of a church again. I'm so glad you did. And I am so sorry that religious people like me gave you the wrong idea about who God is. If you've been chewed up in church, you're not alone. Some of you know a little of my story. I'm not exaggerating. I think all of my highest highs and my lowest lows took place in church among God's people. The sanctuary has been the place where I met God. Church has been the primary place where I've been taught how to live like Jesus. Over the years, church leaders and church people have taught me how to carry life differently in Jesus. Some of the most important lessons I learned in church. I met my closest friends in church, the people who love me the most, the people I trust the most, the people I like the most. I met them all in God's house. The sanctuary has been a place where I found direction. Direction for big decisions, direction for little decisions. I began to feel God's tug on my life to be a minister in a sanctuary like this. I remember as a sixth grader, a seventh grader, wrestling with God about my future. See, I thought by fifth grade I was destined for law school. But then I began to serve in my church, and I began to experience the feeling of allowing God to use me to love others. And even at that age, I wondered if God was pointing me, prodding me toward vocational ministry. And all along the way, God confirmed his calling, usually in a sanctuary. I told some of you before about one Sunday evening in a sanctuary when I was wrestling with this calling. I'd never told a soul what I was thinking or what I was feeling about ministry. But there was a guest preacher in town. I don't remember his name, but I remember his size. He was massive. Really, the dude was built like a truck or a tank. And he was a fiery preacher with a three-piece suit. after that Sunday evening service concluded, he spent time praying with people. And as he did, he took off his suit jacket and rolled up his sleeves to reveal his body was covered in tattoos. And I'm not sure how tame they were, because he used to be a Hell's Angel. Well, as he was praying with people, I can't explain it, but I felt compelled by God to talk to him. He was talking to someone else as I approach. But when he sees me, he stops talking. In that moment, he looks me in the eye and looks through my soul. And he asks, "Son, God's calling you into ministry, isn't he?" When he asked that question, I wept like a baby. And he pulled me into his strong arms and prayed a potent prayer over me and my future ministry, which means he prayed for you. But see, only God knew what I was thinking. And only God knew what I needed to start thinking and feeling differently about my future. I'm telling you, that was one of the most important moments of my life, and it took place in a sanctuary. It would have been cool if the preacher said that God was calling me to biker ministry. But he didn't, so here I am. It was in a sanctuary like this in January 1997 when God specifically told Suzanne and me to move to Utah. Just not to start a biker ministry. I'm telling you, I received some of my greatest gifts in the sanctuary. But I also received some of my deepest wounds in God's house, from God's people. I've heard the harshest criticisms. I've experienced the greatest disappointment in God's house, from God's people. Maybe that's partly my fault, because I expected too much, naively thinking I'd find just saints without sin. But honestly, most of it cannot be excused. I put my trust in God's people, but God's people failed me. It isn't fair, it isn't right, but it's reality. Nevertheless, my friends, I'm going to stand by this truth. Though God's people fail, God's love will never fail. Some years ago, I told you about one of my favorite professors to whom I owe an enormous debt. I thought it was way too memorable of a tale to tell you again. But this week we were talking, about half our staff hadn't even heard the story. And they said, "You need to tell that again." Look, I loved this teacher. She was a professor of homiletics. Homiletics is the art of preaching. She was the first person to teach me anything significant about public communication. Oh, and she was an amazing orator in her own right. I recall the many times I listened to her sermons, marveling at her craft, while simultaneously experiencing the personal presence of God's Spirit applying the truth of the Bible to my life. Oh, I wish you could hear her. She talked like this. She didn't sound like a preacher with bombast and verbosity. But every time she spoke at our campus chapel service, the room would be packed with students who would hang on her every word. She excelled as a preacher. She excelled as a teacher. I watched this gifted woman make some of the most monotonous information come to life again and again in the classroom. She could take the most mind-numbing facts from the most tedious textbooks and make the words leap off the page. But her best work was teaching about teaching. She handed us, her students, a clear and concise pattern for writing engaging messages. And I'll tell you, one of the greatest lessons I learned from her was how to deliver difficult truth with grace. I mean, she could bring correction and encouragement in the same sentence. And I desperately needed both. Now, when I thought about my vocational calling to ministry, through high school and through most of college, somewhere along the way, I began to assume that I would be an academic ministry, serving as a scholar and a professor, ministering to people by training ministers. I never thought I'd be a pastor or a preacher until I met that professor. She encouraged me. She inspired me. She pointed me in the right direction. In fact, I think I could say this. More than almost anyone else, that woman is responsible for influencing me toward pastoral ministry. But my preaching professor was recently released from a state penitentiary where she was serving a 10-year prison sentence for the attempted murder of her lover's spouse. And here's the problem. I've got a lot of stories like that. Get this. Virtually all of my most important mentors from my most formative years either burned me badly or blew up their lives in a glorious fashion. Sometimes I wonder why I'm not jaded. Sometimes I wonder why I didn't become a surgeon or a stockbroker or politician like my peers. But I guess it's because I learned something about life a long time ago. Though God's people fail, God's love will never fail. Look, it's good to put your hope in people. People who don't trust anyone never experience true love. It's healthy to hope in people, as long as it's not your ultimate hope. See, if you've hung all your happiness on the trustworthiness of any human, you might want to reconsider. People fail. And God's people fail. Now, I'm not bemoaning the state of the church today as if we've slipped from our once lofty position of blamelessness. No, people who long to go back in history when God's people were blameless don't know history. In fact, they aren't even reading the Bible. A cursory reading of the epistles of Paul reveals the first century church was a bag of cats. Gossip, slander, anger, prejudice. And this is because the church is always full of people who sin. Now, I'm not excusing us. I'm explaining our purpose. See, the church exists to make disciples, people who are learning from Jesus how to do life. And disciples aren't perfect. If we were perfect, we wouldn't need discipleship. However, that means every time you walk into church, any church, you're coming face to face with imperfect people who are more likely than not to fail you. I don't think I'm being pessimistic, I'm being realistic. If anything, I'm an optimist. Because I believe God has grace for the failures of his people if only we receive it and walk in it. My friends, I long for you to hear this message. If God's people fail you, when God's people fail you, don't ever forget God's love will never fail you. And friends, this principle goes for me too. If you stick around long enough, I am highly likely to disappoint you. I may hurt you. I may fail you. Please don't hitch your spiritual wagon to me. Everybody hear me. Rest assured, I've made no plans to blow up my life. And I hope in King Jesus that I don't. But I might hurt you by accident. Many of the hurts we receive in the sanctuary are not wounds anyone doled out intentionally. But see, it's not about blame. It's about pain. And pain that comes by accident needs healing, just like pain that comes by intent. So where do we find healing? What do we do with the wounds given by God's people, intentional or accidental? What do we do with the feelings of injustice when we've been burned by dirty dogs like Doeg? To find an answer, let's look again at Psalm 52. Why do you boast of evil, you mighty hero? Why do you boast all day long, you who are a disgrace in the eyes of God. And these are harsh words, but they're instructive words, the heading tells us. So what does God want us to learn? You who practice deceit, your tongue plots destruction. It's like a sharpened razor. Obviously, Doeg used his sword to work ruin. But his words were where the evil began. Just like a razor, the tongue can be used to harm or help. You love evil rather than good, falsehood rather than speaking the truth. You love every harmful word, you deceitful tongue. Does it bother anyone that David confronts falsehood in the same context in which he deceived the holy priest of God? Because it probably should bother you. But let's learn from David's words, not from David's ways. He claims, surely God will bring you down to everlasting ruin. He will snatch you up and pluck you from your tent. He will uproot you from the land of the living. In The Message, Eugene Peterson brings the words of Psalm 52 to life by saying it like we'd say it today. He writes, why do you brag of evil, big man? God's mercy carries the day. You scheme catastrophe. Your tongue cuts razor sharp, artisan in lies. You love evil more than good. You call black white. You love malicious gossip, you foul mouth. God will tear you limb from limb, sweep you up and throw you out, pull you up by the roots from the land of life. Question. Was this psalm actually written to Doeg? Probably not. Doeg probably never read it. But it wasn't intended for Doeg. It was intended for us. When David wrote it, he meant it to teach us something about life and God. It's a creative way of reminding us that ultimately there will be consequences to our actions. Doegs don't get away with it in the end. And just like Taylor or Alanis or Carly teaching you that your future doesn't have to be controlled by the boyfriends of your past, David reminds the reader, justice is coming. Verse 6, the righteous will see and fear. They will laugh at you, saying, here now is the man who did not make God his stronghold, but trusted in his great wealth and grew strong by destroying others. Doeg knew his actions would make him rich and powerful. But the righteous don't trust riches and power. Fear here is another way of talking about trust. It's not terror, it's respect and holy awe. The righteous trust God's way of doing life over and above Doeg's way. Psalm 52 is telling us how David deals with his anger by remembering the ultimate outcome. But understand, David's not just angry at Doeg, because Doeg isn't the only one responsible. See, after the priestly family was slain by the Edomite, we find back in 1 Samuel 22, verse 20, one son of Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled to join David. He told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar, that day, when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he would be sure to tell Saul, I am responsible for the death of your whole family. See, when David writes Psalm 52, David's dealing with guilt. Often God's person who fails is the person you see when you look in the mirror. So what do you do with the guilt of being the failure? Maybe the same thing you do with the anger. Again, I think we'll find Eugene Peterson's wisdom instructive. He said, the story of David isn't set before us as a moral model to copy. David isn't a person whose actions we're inspired to imitate. In the company of David, we don't feel inadequate because we know we could never do it that well. Just the opposite. in the company of David, we find someone who does it as badly as, or worse, than we do. But who in the process doesn't quit, doesn't withdraw from God? Whether David fails or David's furious, he continues to seek God. Verse 8, but I am like an olive tree flourishing in the house of God. I trust in God's unfailing love forever and ever. Unfailing love translates the Hebrew word chesed. It's one of the most significant words in the Bible. It's loaded with meaning. We translate it with the words grace, loyalty, loving kindness, faithfulness, goodness, steadfast love. Chesed describes the unceasing love of God, a love that's committed and faithful when our love's fickle and unfaithful. It's an unceasing sticky love. It sticks to us when we don't stick to Him. Though David has sinned and been sinned on, he compares himself to an olive tree. Now, the olive tree was a symbol of well-being in the ancient Near East. The fruit of the olive tree was used for food. It was used for medicine. It was used for perfume. It was used for sacred anointings. The olive tree was an important tree that was always well attended. David says, even in the midst of this injustice, even dealing with his guilt, he thrives like an olive tree tended by the divine gardener. Why? It's because he's placed his trust not in God's people who often fail, but in God's love that never fails. Look, even if the most important people in your life fail you, your faith doesn't have to fail, because you can place that faith in something far more trustworthy than people. Friends, I'm telling you, though God's people fail, God's love will never fail. But practically speaking, what does it look like to trust God's unfailing love? What can I do when I'm wounded, when I'm brokenhearted, when I'm disappointed and disillusioned? What are some specific steps I can take to trust in God's unfailing love? Because I need this to be accessible, don't you? Well, I think the final verse in the psalm hands us a manual. It instructs us on what we can do to trust in God's unfailing love. See, when we're wounded by the failed love of someone else, David writes this, for what you have done, verse 9, I will always praise you in the presence of your faithful people, and I will hope in your name, for your name is good. That verb praise means thank. One way to recalibrate your heart and your mind to trust God's unfailing love is to get your eyes off God's failing people and focus on His love by thinking about the things for which you're grateful. We're talking about gratitude. Friends, we've got to get deliberate about where we train our brains. Remember the words of Dallas that I shared last month? A mature disciple of Jesus must be very intentional about what she allows herself to think and what she allows herself to feel. When you intentionally focus your thoughts on the good things that God has done and is doing, your feelings will follow, and so will your joy, and so will your peace. No, it won't take away all the pain, but it'll jump start the healing process. Gratitude. For what you've done, I will always thank you. Look at verse 9 again. I will hope in your name, for your name is good. And another way we enact our trust in God's unfailing love is to make sure we've placed our hope in the proper place. David put his hope in God's name. He put his hope in God's character. We often say around here, trust God's character, not particular outcomes. It's one thing to trust God to answer your prayers. It's another thing to trust God to answer your prayers however He thinks best. And that's a greater hope. Finally, I want to draw one more principle from the passage. Where does David find himself giving thanks to God? In the presence of God's faithful people. What is this telling you? It's telling you, David doesn't let his past experience of spiritual community prevent him from having a new experience of spiritual community. And I'm going to challenge you not to do that either. Don't wall yourself off from God's people because you've been hurt by some others. Because though God's people fail, God's love will never fail. Let me pray. Lord, I pray for my friends that they, especially those who have been wounded in the sanctuary, may they find healing. Some of these wounds are really deep, Lord. Some of my friends here have experienced a controlling religious legalism. Others, there's no other way to say it, have just been abused. And God, by your grace, would you show yourself to be very near that man or that woman, that boy or that girl. And may you do a work of healing their wounds. The wounds in their heart and their mind, their thoughts and their feelings. Make them whole again. And I pray you would heal them in such a way that their experience of hurt and healing can be used to help others heal too. And here, Lord, I want to pray for my friends who are watching online or here in the room with me. And they don't trust you yet. They're not so sure about all this God stuff. Maybe because they've been hurt by your people. Lord, may they experience you in this message. May they experience you reaching out to them with that unfailing love of yours, inviting them to take steps to trust you again in spite of your people. I pray this in the name of King Jesus. Amen. Okay, friends, I got some homework for you. And this is important, so stay with me. A few assignments here. Here's the first one. Simple, but significant. Ask God to heal you. Ask God to heal you. Maybe you were wounded so long ago you don't even think about this anymore. But if as I was talking, those wounds, you realize they might not have closed yet. They might not have healed. This is a moment. Over the next few days, ask God to heal you. See what he does. See what opportunities he brings your way to find healing. Secondly, take intentional steps to experience his healing. Now this healing is going to be a work of God, but you might need to take steps to turn toward it. We turn toward his grace. We turn toward his mercy. It's what we do, right? What are the steps you need to take? I don't know. It'll be different for every one of us. Maybe you need to research and find a book on emotional and spiritual healing because of the wounds you've experienced. Grace to you. Do the work, friends. You won't regret it. Will it be hard? Absolutely. Will it force you to think through and process some of this? Absolutely. And it won't be a trip to Disneyland. But the healing that God might do through that experience, it'll pay off big dividends in the years and decades to come. Take the steps you need to take. Maybe you need to see a counselor. Maybe you need to connect with someone who loves God and loves you and has a little more training. So someone, a therapist who might point you in some new directions toward healing. If you're interested in that, send us an email, info@capitalchurch.com. We got a list of great counseling partners that we use around the area, and we'd love to connect you with one of those. Here's the third thing. I want you to thank God for something every day. Thank God for something every day. That's that we're putting into practice verse 9 of Psalm 52. It's our way of getting our eyes off the failure of God's people and on to the good things that God has done, how he's shown us his unfailing love, okay? Make gratitude a habit, friends. And here's another assignment I want to give you. And this one might be hard for a couple of you, but I'm going to encourage you to never give up on God's people. Now, you might need to have boundaries with somebody. There might be someone who claims to be one of God's people that you need to remove from your life because they are not healthy and they are quite harmful. That's not what I'm talking about. Actions like that should be done. They should be done within godly community and with great love, right? Sometimes the most loving thing we can do is take a step back from a relationship that's not healthy. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about taking a risk, a calculated risk on spiritual friendship. We'll say more about that in a couple weeks. Okay, a couple other things. As I was thinking about how people have been hurt in church, particularly over the last several years, I'm going to step in it when I go here, but I'm going to step in it anyway. I think one of the ways that churches in America have wounded more people, it is how we've approached the subject of politics. And maybe politics is one way the church has burned you. Maybe a church leader spoke up in favor of a politician that offended you. Maybe they spoke out against a politician that you like. Maybe they didn't speak out at all. And that bothers you deeply because your political party says everybody should be speaking up now. And maybe they're right. I have a different philosophy on how a church should involve itself in politics. And an interesting explanation, a compact explanation of my thoughts on the matter can be found in a book. I didn't write it. It was written by a pastor named Andy Stanley, and the book is called Not In It to Win It. Look at the subtitle of this book. If you can't read it, I'll say it. It's Why Choosing Sides Sidelines the Church. Now, here, Andy, a leader I respect, offers a good explanation of how I think about the church and politics. So if you're interested, pick it up. It's very small. You can read it fast. In fact, I almost recommended this book a couple years ago when it first came out. And it was for a message I did. We were in 1 Corinthians, and love is patient, not prickly. Remember this thing? And we were talking about how easily offended we are. And oh my word, are we so easily politically offended these days, aren't we? And I was going to recommend it at the end of that message, and I didn't have time to read the whole book, so I read about half the book, and I'm like, this is genius. I dig this book. And I was just going to quit reading it and recommend it. And then I had this thing, read the book. So I powered through the rest of the book, and I realized the second half of the book I didn't agree with at all. And let me be clear. I love Andy Stanley. I've learned so much from him as a leader. We don't agree on everything, not even close, but I like him a lot, and he's my brother, and God uses him to do wonderful things in his kingdom. But what I disagreed with Andy in this book on, it was not necessarily his political theory. It was his biblical theology. In sum, Andy has a different view of how we read the Old Testament today than I do. And so keep in mind, I literally just taught through the Old Testament to you today. So that'll give you a little perspective on how what I think on the matter, okay? But I'm going to go ahead and recommend this book anyway with that caveat. See, here's my philosophy. If you only learn from people with whom you agree about everything, then you won't learn very much. Everybody hear me? And friends, I think that's why we're so siloed politically and theologically. Now, I get it. The main reason we do that is fear. We don't want to have their evil thoughts seeping into our lives or our communities. And look, there's something to that, and we've got to be wise, right? We've got to be wise. But my word, you don't have to be utterly offended to learn from somebody you disagree with in three or four areas. Let's listen. Let's learn. Let's be loving. Parents, let's teach our kids to think critically. Teach our kids to think for themselves. They're going to do that anyway, okay? Okay, one more bit of homework, and I've kept you too long. My word, have I kept you too long. And I don't even think this homework is a good idea. I'm probably going to offend you again. But my daughter would recommend you all download The Tortured Poets Department from Taylor Swift. Her father would encourage you to make sure it's the non-explicit version, for gosh sakes. Stand with me. Psalm 52, verse 8, your verse for the week. Take it with you. The image on the screen, the graphic that follows, can be downloaded from our website. If you'd like to receive prayer, we'll have people here at the front to pray for you. You can also always send us an email, care@capitalchurch.com, especially for those of you online. Look, I really have kept you too long. And parents, could you help me with something? We're going to have a fast turnover with our gathering for the next service. And so could you go get your kids fast? And when you see that volunteer that's been with your kid, can you thank them for letting God work through them to minister to your kid and to you while we were up here? Can you do that? Here's my prayer for all of you, friends. If God's people fail you, when God's people fail you, may you never forget that God's love will never fail you. Thanks for coming to church. Grace and peace.